Kathy's Facebook page and wish her a happy birthday, will you, friends? We got a special show today. I am very, very blessed and pleased to welcome my good friend Bill Salas to Dr. Mike Live. Bill, welcome.
Mike, it's great to be on your Dr. Mike Live. I think this is the first time I've been on Dr. Mike Live. I've been on your other radio show before.
Yes, yes. I'm going to say this is your fourth, maybe fifth appearance, which makes you the number one guest on my show. And so I appreciate you joining, especially since I just reached out to you late last week and asked, and you were very gracious with your time. So thank you very much. My listeners already know who you are, but I'm going to read this anyway. Bill is a best-selling author, conference speaker, of course. Many of you have heard Bill in person at different conferences that he speaks at. He's got a new book out that fantastic book. I think you can see it right there, The Next Prophecies. Now, this is book two of a projected trilogy that puts a possible chronological order to the prophetic events of the end times. Now, if you're interested in getting that, you can go to Bill's website. It's up there. Jared's got it up, Prophecy Depot Ministries. You can check it out there, Prophecy Depot Ministries. I would encourage you to get the Now Prophecies as well. Now we're going to do a segue from the Now to the Next, and the reason that is important is because the Now Prophecies, in fact, Bill, this might be a good place for us to start. The Now Prophecies, you wrote about what appears to be imminent, what's on the horizon. You talked about the disaster in Iran. You talked about the destruction of Damascus. You talked about the decline of America. What distinguishes, Bill, the Now from the Next, your latest book, The Now Prophecies from the Next Prophecies? What distinguishes that?
Well, the Now Prophecies are the unfulfilled ancient biblical predictions that appear to be imminent, which means they could happen now at the present time. They're foretellings that have minor or no preconditions, so we could literally wake up one morning in the very nearby future, and then they could be finding their fulfillment. And conversely, the Next Prophecies have some minor preconditions that are prohibiting them from finding their fulfillment at the present time. But they're stage setting. This is what's interesting, is that all these end times biblical prophecies are stage setting, they're converging, they're drawing near, but they, of course, they won't happen at the same time. They will sequence themselves. So I distinguish the remaining unfulfilled biblical prophecies into three categories: now, they could happen at the present time; next, which will happen after the nows, have some preconditions which the nows, when they find fulfillment, will take care of and eliminate those preconditions. And then the last prophecies actually have some, you know, fairly serious preconditions as well, prohibiting them from coming forward. But again, those are also stage setting, like the coming of the Antichrist and the harlot world religion and things like that. So actually, the harlot world religion, I believe, could actually be a next prophecy, because I think in the immediate aftermath of the rapture, we will have the harlot world religion come in into fulfillment.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and let me say this for those that have joined us today. Bill and I share very similar views on prophecy and the events and the unfolding of the book of Revelation, the sealed judgments, and so on. We've discussed this at length on a number of different shows that we've done, and I would just encourage you to check that out on Soaring Eagle Radio. Bill and I have chatted three times on prophetic events, and so I encourage you to do that. One of the things, Bill, that you point out very early in the Next Prophecies book is the Ezekiel 38:39, the Gog of Magog invasion, and the timing of that. Now I know there is some disagreement in the prophetic world in which we operate. Some think that it is a pre-rapture, pre-trib kind of thing, but in your book, you're making the case that it is a post-rapture, pre-trib event, and we'll segue into the whole gap time viewpoint, but my question to you, Bill, is why do you think Ezekiel 38:39 is a next prophecy, and where does it fall?
Well, I think there are some preconditions spelled out in Ezekiel 38 verses 8 through 13 that have to be met, that aren't met presently at the current time. It says in those verses that Israel will be, you know, brought back from the nations, brought back from the sword of persecution. And I believe those things, of course, are going on and have been going on for over 70 years. Israel celebrated its 70-year anniversary this past May 14th. But there, it also says that they will be a peaceful people living in unwalled villages. They will be dwelling securely, and it mentions that two times, without walls, without bars, and without gates. And then it goes on to say they will be a very rich country, a very prosperous country, because the motivation of the invaders, the Magog invaders, is to come after Israel's livelihood, their plunder, their great booty, it says in those verses. So, and Israel is en route to being a very prosperous country, but Israel is not dwelling securely without walls, bars, nor gates. Matter of fact, in the book I put forward some headlines that are relatively recent. And by the way, you know, we should, when we talk about Ezekiel 38, let me make this qualification real quickly to talk about it. It is one of the most literal, one of the easiest prophecies to understand, and should be interpreted literally almost every verse. I find no verse in those 52 verses in Ezekiel 38 and 39 that cannot be taken literally. They don't need to be allegorized. And I want to tell you that because when I start reading the headlines about the walls that exist, we have to look at that description being very literal. So here's the golden rule of interpretation. Dr. David L. Cooper put this forward. He was around between 1886 and 1965. He was the founder of the Biblical Research Society. And here's what he says. When the plain sense of Scripture makes common sense, seek no other sense. Therefore, take every word at its primary, ordinary, usual, literal meaning, unless the facts of the immediate context studied in light of related passages and axiomatic fundamental truths indicate clearly otherwise. So basically what he's saying is when the plain sense makes common sense, seek no other sense. So when we keep that in mind, we look at these headlines dealing with these walls. It says literally they'll be dealing without walls, bars, no gates. They'll be living in unwalled villages. Here's just a few headlines. This is June of 2012 in the Times of Israel. Israel completes a Lebanon border wall around Matula. So that's a wall to the north of Israel. Here's one in May of 2018 at the Times of Israel. Israel starts building a sea barrier to defend against the Gaza attacks, actually going out into the sea to build a barrier to protect Israel from attacks coming around, you know, into the seacoast on the west of Israel. Here's one in Los Angeles Times in April of 2008. Palestinian protesters breach Israel's Gaza border fence. Three killed, hundreds injured. So fences on the Gaza. Here's one dealing with Jordan. They've even got a wall to the east dealing with Jordan. The Times of Israel, January of 2006. Israel starts a massive fence on the southern border with Jordan. And in fact, right now they're building a wall that is a 30-foot tall border wall that goes up in the north to protect from Hezbollah coming and infiltrating into northern communities of Israel. Matter of fact, this came out in the Times of Israel in September of 2018, September 6th, so just last month. And here's a little caption on it. The Israeli military this week publicly unveiled its 11-kilometer-long, 9-meter-tall concrete border wall along the Lebanese border. The concrete barrier is designed to serve two main functions, protect Israeli civilians and soldiers from sniper attacks, and to prevent infiltration into Israel by Hezbollah operatives. And that's, in the ancient times, that's why they built fences and walls, was to protect against infiltration. So, I mean, to me, that is one issue. They're not dwelling without walls, bars, nor gates, and nor are they dwelling securely. And by the way, they also have a 400-plus long mile wall inside of Israel, that partition wall. And at some points, that's 20 feet high, filled with concrete. So, I mean, to me, we have to look literally at the fact they're not dwelling without walls, bars, nor gates, nor are they dwelling securely.
Yeah. Yes. Very good point. Okay, let's discuss the timing of this, Bill. From your perspective, Ezekiel 38 and 39, what is the timing, and then that'll naturally lead into a discussion of the post-rapture pre-tribulation time gap. Now, this may be news to some folks that are watching. They've never heard this before. It's not actually something something new. Scholars have been talking about this for a while, and so you're going to find out as we work our way through Bill's book, The Next Prophecies. By the way, folks, if you've just joined us, that's what we're talking about. My guest today is author Bill Salas, and we're talking about The Next Prophecies. And the question to Bill was the prophecies concerning Ezekiel 38-39, the Gog and Magog invasion, and why that cannot be in a current context. Something dramatic, drastic has to happen. And the number one thing that I always look at is that Israel is not dwelling securely in their own land. They simply are not. When might that happen? Well, I think that leads in, Bill, to your view on the post-rapture, pre-tribulation gap, time gap, where some very significant things can happen. Can you talk about your view on that?
Okay, sure. So let's talk about the timing of Ezekiel 38, and then we'll get into how that will actually probably fit into that gap, so we can talk about that gap. The fulfillment of Ezekiel 38 will happen after Israel dwells securely, and that will happen in fulfillment of the prophecy spoken about in Ezekiel 28, 10 chapters earlier, verses 24 through 26. It'll happen after Ezekiel 28, but before the tribulation period. So let's talk about what happens after Ezekiel 28. Ezekiel 28 tells us when Israel will dwell securely. He uses the same Hebrew words in Ezekiel 38 that he uses in Ezekiel 28. He uses them two times in both of those chapters. They're Yeshav V'tach, and it means dwelling securely. And the precedent that Ezekiel gives us for using those words is it's dwelling securely because you have militarily taken out your enemies and don't have to worry about them anymore. I'm paraphrasing, but it's not land for peace deals. It's not diplomacy. So Ezekiel tells us in Ezekiel 28, verses 24 through 26, that I'm going to paraphrase. I'm not going to read the passages, but it says that Israel has enemies around them that despise them. And they are like a prickling briar and a crown of thorns to them. And until the judgments are executed upon those around them who despise them, Israel won't dwell securely. And so I invite the listeners to read Ezekiel 28, verses 24 through 26. The ones around them that despise them are not the Ezekiel 38 invaders. The Ezekiel 38 invaders don't share common borders with Israel. They've never been Israel's enemies throughout time, and they're not the ones being spoken about in Ezekiel 28. The ones around Israel would be where Hezbollah is to the north in Lebanon. Syria is still at war with Israel. Israel has struck Syria over 200 times in the last 2 years. You've got the Jordanians, although they have a fragile peace treaty with Israel, they show up in prophecies in the end times where that peace treaty does not show up, and Israel goes to war with them and wins. Those are now prophecies. You got Hamas, and or the Philistia, ancient Philistia, where the Gaza is. The Palestinians, Egyptians, although there's a fragile peace treaty with them also, they also show up in biblical prophecies where Israel comes against them, unfulfilled prophecies. And then the Saudis could probably be in there as well. They happen to all be in the Psalm 83 prophecy and in many other peripheral prophecies that I believe connect to Psalm 83, and I think that has to happen first. Judgments will be executed upon those around them who despise Israel in Ezekiel 28. Israel will dwell securely. And then in the aftermath, Russia will put together its coalition with Iran and Turkey, and there's nine members altogether, some countries, North African continent, some of the breakaway Soviet Republic countries, maybe some of the East African countries as well, will come against Israel, and that's when Israel will be dwelling securely without walls, bars, nor gates. They get defeated by God supernaturally with an earthquake, fire, hailstone, and brimstone. And in the aftermath, we understand that Israel will be burying the dead for 7 months and converting the weapons into fuel for 7 years. So I say that is a clue that they'll be burning the weapons or converting it into fuel for 7 years. That's a clue when you understand this 7-year tribulation period, how it breaks down. that this prophecy of Ezekiel 38 will be fulfilled before the tribulation. So here's how this works. The first 3.5 years of the tribulation, Israel is experiencing a false peace, a pseudo peace. They feel comfortable because they have confirmed they've been part of a false covenant in Daniel 29, verse 7, also in Isaiah 28, verse 15, is the proof text for that covenant. They have a covenant with some party. They feel they can dwell securely for 3.5 years, so therefore they could burn weapons for 3.5 years, you know, of that 7-year total time span. But in the second half of that 3.5 years, even Jesus Christ says in Matthew 24, verse 15, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel the prophet, that those who are in Judea should flee to the mountains. And he's referring to when the Antichrist goes into the temple in the middle of the tribulation period, there'll be a tribulation temple in Israel, in Jerusalem, and he will do an abominable act. And the Jews need to flee for their lives, Jesus is warning them. And so they won't be burning weapons. They'll be fleeing for their lives. If anything, they'll be grabbing a weapon to use it in their fight for, you know, refuge. So the theory, and this is not just my theory, there are others who believe in this, Dr. Ron Rhodes, Dr. Ronald Fruchtenbaum, Dr. David Reagan, just to name a few, is that Israel could burn weapons for 3.5 years before the tribulation. They could burn 3.5 years during the first half of the tribulation, but they would not be burning weapons in the second half. Therefore, we would consider it a pre-tribulation event.
Yes. Yeah. Very good synopsis, Bill. You know, folks, the world is changing rapidly. So fast, it's infuriating for me as I watch the things that happen in America today. I can't help but view it through a prophetic lens, a prophetic understanding, and wonder if evil is ramping up, Bill, as rapidly as it is, and we see it in almost every context. One of the things that should do for believers is encourage us to share the gospel of salvation through faith alone in Christ alone while we still have time. Work while it is still day, in other words. Because once the Lord intervenes and removes his church, and Bill and I share this viewpoint, this eschatology, if you will, that we are both believers in a pre-tribulation rapture of the body of Christ, and we'll get into that during this program. But one of the things that's going to happen after the rapture of the church, when we enter into this post-rapture, even pre-trib time period, is the rise of the harlot church. Now, that is talked about in the book of Revelation. And this harlot church, this beast system, I see it organizing right in front of my eyes today, Bill. What do you think?
Well, I think it is as well. You know, what happens after the rapture is you have the Satan is loosed. He's no longer restrained to put forward his supernatural signs, you know, lying signs and wonders, and to reveal the Antichrist, the lawless one. That's in 2 Thessalonians 2. He's known for a couple thousand years, ever since 2 Thessalonians 2 was written around 52 or 53 AD, that he would have his time in the sun to put forward his closing arguments. So he's planned, and all that leads toward not only the revealing of the Antichrist, the lawless one, but to deceive humanity that they would believe in what the Bible calls the lie. And that is what Satan's planning on doing when he's no longer restrained. And the common teaching is that the restraint is removed from Satan at a synonymous time when the rapture of the church occurs. So therefore, when that happens, he's not going to slap his forehead and go, oy vey, what do I do now? He's already got this plan. And he's got a double jeopardy for a man already planned, and he's going to do it with supernatural deception. It'll be a time when the supernatural is the natural, the paranormal will be the new normal. So what he's going to do at first is he's going to have a harlot world religion, a global world religion that's going to captivate the attention of the masses. That's Mystery Babylon of Revelation chapter 17. We find out that the Antichrist in Revelation 17 verse 3 is in an unholy alliance with this world religion, as he's coming into his power and into his charismatic world leadership. It says in Revelation 17:3 that the harlot will ride the beast or sit on the beast. So he's in a subservient position initially, the Antichrist. And then it says in Revelation 17:7 that the beast carries the harlot. So he helps prop her up into, the eyes of mankind. Ultimately, the harlot world religion, so therefore Satan must have this religion in place, and he probably already has a point man, an Antichrist, determined. He probably always has, although that person probably doesn't know who he is yet, because Satan never really knew when the restraint was going to be removed. So I personally believe, and I put forward in the Next Prophecies book, the strong arguments that the harlot world religion, which is centered in a great city, we're told in Revelation 17:18 that it is the mystery was told to John that this is the great city that he saw that reigns over the kings of the earth. And in John's time, that city was Rome. We're also told part of the mystery of Mystery Babylon is that it sits on seven hills. And that was also the name for Rome, the eternal city that sits on seven hills. And so I believe that Satan has been working to prop up through the Catholic Church this massive deception. The Catholic Church will be left behind as an institution. I point that out in the book. And also, they are not believing in a pre-trib rapture. They are amillennial. They would be shocked if they are taken from the earth because they believe they're on the earth to restore it into a Garden of Eden-like conditions. Basically, to answer your question, I believe the harlot world religion is already in place, and I believe that will come out through manifestation through the Vatican, centered in Rome.
Yes. So once the church is removed, Bill, a lot of things are going to start happening. One of them is that the Antichrist will appear on the scene, and that's 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 5 through 10. It says that he will appear when the restrainer is removed. It refers to the Antichrist there as the lawless one. What does the Antichrist do, Bill, as a first priority? What is his focus and goal on, top of the list, first priority, once he arrives on the scene?
Well, he's going to fulfill a three-stage career. He's going to be a political leader because we find out in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, and Isaiah chapter 28, that he will be trusted by Israel to confirm a covenant between Israel and, Daniel says, the many. Isaiah 28 says, between death and Sheol. And in the book, I put a face on, an identity on who that represents. So he's going to be a political leader. He will, much like Bill Clinton was respected by Israel to confirm the covenant with Jordan in 1994, Jimmy Carter was respected by Israel to confirm the covenant with Egypt prior to that around 1979. This guy will gain Israel's trust, and he will also have the trust of the other signatory to the false covenant, who I believe will be the harlot. And he's got a relationship with the harlot. We talked about the harlot will sit on the beast. He will carry her. So, but not to get off topic, he will be a political leader that will be respected. He will be a world political leader. Then he will also be a military leader. People, countries and kings that stand in his way will be taken out. Daniel 7, verse 24 tells us that there's actually, among the 10 kings, ultimately, three of them are subdued by the Antichrist. We're told in Daniel 11, verse 40, that there's battles with the king of the north and the king of the south, and the Antichrist wins. But ultimately where it goes is he will be a supreme religious leader. In Revelation chapter 13, verses 15, 18, the very familiar passages where it talks about the false prophet will make an image to the beast, the Antichrist, and everybody will be forced to worship him. If they don't, they will be killed. And that no one will buy or sell unless they take his mark upon his right hand or their right hand or upon their forehead. So he's got a threefold campaign: political leader, military leader, and supreme religious leader. So I think initially what he comes out doing is rising to political power and becoming strong militarily.
Yeah. You said earlier, just a few moments ago, Bill, that the harlot is the signatory to this false covenant. Now, that took some fleshing out in your book. And by the way, folks, again, the book is The Next Prophecies. We're discussing with author Bill Salas. I appreciate that you took the time to really flesh this out and to discuss it in great detail, what all of this means, because the Antichrist merely confirms the covenant, but there are signatories to that covenant along with Israel, more than one, but they both trace back, and I'll just tell folks for the sake of expediency, death and Sheol, or death and Hades, but they trace back to the harlot church, don't they, Bill?
Yes, and you're right. I like the way you said it took some time to work that out, because this was, you know, involved, you know, putting a lot of puzzle pieces together to get the major picture. You know, when you talk about the false covenant, which starts the tribulation period, also Daniel's 70th week, the main proof text that people quote from is Daniel 9:27, which tells us some important things. It tells us that it's a seven-year term. It talks about a week, 70th week, but it's a week of seven-year terms. It's confirmed by the Antichrist. And in the middle of the 7 years, he goes into the temple and he voids out that, you know, that covenant, because he stops the sacrifices that are going on. So Daniel 9:27 also suggests to us that has something to do with the temple and the enablement of sacrifices again. But there's another proof text written well over a century dealing with that false covenant that is hardly mentioned much and maybe not known by a lot of our colleagues. And that's on Isaiah 28 verses 15. And in those verses, it says, it tells us Israel's motivation, who the other signatory is, and that their involvement is, they get involved in this covenant, and it's a false covenant because it's sort of, it's deceitful. Israel realizes it's a deceitful covenant. So I'm going to read the Isaiah 28 verse 15. Because it's critical information, and if we're going to ultimately find out who's the signatory, is you have to start with Isaiah 28 verses 15, and it says, "Because you have said, we have made a covenant with death, and with Sheol we are in agreement. When the overflowing scourge passes through, it will not come to us, for we have made lies our refuge, and under falsehood we have hidden ourselves." So what we're told there is, they made a covenant with death, and they're in agreement with Sheol. So we got to say, well, what is that? Because you can't make a covenant with intangibles like death. And they're trying to avoid something that's being perpetrated by death and Sheol. It's called an overflowing scourge. So we have to figure out, well, what is that? What is concerning Israel to get them to come to the bargaining table? And then it also says that they have hidden themselves in lies and falsehood. So in other words, it's politically expedient for them to be involved with death and Sheol in this covenant, because they don't want that overflowing scourge to pass through. So then the connection is made when you look and say, well, where did death and Sheol show up in the future? You know, so that they can actually be on the world scene at the time when that covenant is made. And they show up in the fourth horseman of the book of Revelation in the seal judgments. And it says in there, the seal is opened, and the angel says to John, come and see. And he says, and I looked, and there was a pale horse, and on him who sat on it was death, and Hades followed him. And Hades is the Greek word for Sheol in the Hebrew. So they show up in as the fourth horseman in the book of Revelation chapter 6. And that fourth horseman is perpetrating an overflowing scourge. It says the death and Hades have a power given to them, or an authority given to them, over a fourth part of the earth. So, you know, some estimate that could be a billion people. Well, there's 1.2 billion Catholics. Let's just use that number. Not to say that some Catholics won't be raptured, but the institution will be left behind. Power is given over them, a fourth part of the earth, to kill with sword, with hunger, with death, and with the beasts of the earth. So this is going to be a huge network that's going to come on the scene at an important time when the other seals have been opened and world wars have happened with the second horseman, the second seal, famine, scarcities, and pestilences with the third seal. So here they come in to maybe rein in some kind of normalcy and amidst the chaos, but they are a dangerous system. And I believe it's a harlot world system, and there's another step we have to take to get to that. But the bottom line is they're killing, you know, the authority over a quarter of the earth to kill, and they're killing a lot of people, at least the fifth seal saints. We'll find out in the next seal. And Israel doesn't want to be their next victim. They don't want to be part of that overflowing scourge. They're not going to buy into whatever Death and Hades is teaching, because at that time the Jews are going to want to build their temple and reinstate the Mosaic law and do animal sacrifices. But they will covenant with this entity so that they can build their temple and be left alone. So, and then we have to figure out, well, how did Bill come up with the harlot world religion as the pale horse? So that's a whole nother chapter.
which we're going to get to. So let's back up just a little bit, Bill, because the sealed judgments, there's a traditional view, certainly one that I was taught, that I learned when I was going through school, and most folks in my flavor, in my branch, if you will, Calvary Chapel pastors, learned a particular system of theology. There is a traditional view of the sealed judgments, and that places them really within the 7-year tribulation period. All of those seals will be opened, but there's maybe a case to be made that they're not all opened during the 7-year. In fact, some of them may be opened during that time gap period, right?
Right, and we haven't really spoken and defined the time gap. So let me do that, and then let me talk about the traditional alternative views of the timing of the sealed judgments. The time gap that we're referring to is, it's not the rapture that starts the tribulation period. It's the confirmation of the false covenant that we just talked about in Isaiah 28 and Daniel chapter 9.
Yes.
So so when the Christians are raptured out, it doesn't mean Israel all of a sudden goes, boy, we need to confirm that covenant. We're concerned that there's an overflowing scourge. Well, the overflowing scourge hasn't happened yet. It's just that the millions of Christians have disappeared. So there's a period of time between the rapture and the overflowing scourge being perpetrated by death in Hades, at which point Israel says, we need to go to the bargaining table and make a covenant with death in Sheol. So that's the time gap. I call it the post-rapture because it happens after the rapture, and the pre-trib. So post-rapture, pre-tribulation time gap, because it happens before the tribulation. Now, as you stated, that's not my invention. I mean, that gap is, been, there's a few names of people who your listeners may be aware of who subscribe to the fact that there is a gap between the rapture and the tribulation. Gary Stearman of Prophecy Watchers, Dr. David Reagan. Those two actually believe that gap could be several years, as do I. And Mike, let me just stop there for a minute. If it's several years, you can imagine that's going to be a powerful time, because the rapture has happened, the restraint has been removed from Satan, the harlot world religion is emerging, the Antichrist is coming out on the scene. I mean, you'd imagine the Bible's had something to say about that period of time. Pastor Billy Crone believes in it, Joel Rosenberg, Dr. Mark Hitchcock, Dr. Ron Rhodes, Fruchtenbaum, Thomas Ice, former Dr. Chuck Missler, Hal Lindsey, Dr. Tim LaHaye, Dr. David Hawking. I mean, I could go on and on. So the gap is not a new theory. Right. But going into the gap, exploring what could happen in that gap period is what I've dared to do in the next prophecies book. But so that's the gap. Now, as far as the timing of the seals, the traditional teaching, and of course, this could be right. I'm non-dogmatic on what I introduce into the book, but I present the traditional view and the alternative view. The traditional view is that the tribulation period starts when the first seal is opened, because the first seal is the white horseman who comes on the scene. He's given a bow, he's given a crown, and he goes out conquering and to conquer. He goes forth conquering and to conquer. And the common teaching is that's the Antichrist. So, okay, here comes the Antichrist. He's the confirmer of the false covenant. So the major premise is the tribulation can't start until the Antichrist confirms a covenant. Minor premise, the Antichrist can't confirm a covenant until the first seal is open and the Antichrist comes on the scene. Very logical. I understand it. The problem I have with that is that it doesn't specifically tell us in the text that that's when the tribulation starts. The Greek word for covenant that's used 30 times in the New Testament is diatheke, and it refers to the Abrahamic covenant. It refers to the New Covenant, and I show the verses and stuff inside of the book. And it's the Greek translation of the Hebrew word for covenant, breath. And Berith is also used for the Noahic covenant, the Abrahamic covenant, the New Covenant, but it's also used for the Daniel 9:27 and Isaiah 28 covenant. That word is not used. So when I say basically strike one, that's kind of an issue for me. If this was going to be clear that this is where the false covenant starts, then that word should have been inserted there. It is the only suitable word. So I say, I give that a strike one. The text of Revelation 6, 1 and 2 does not specifically state that the covenant, diatheke, of Isaiah and Daniel gets confirmed by the Antichrist when the first seal judgment is open. You know, that's kind of a weak argument, you know, just a strike one. But strike two that I have a problem with is that the other signatory of the false covenant, you remember the Antichrist only confirms it, and Israel is on the scene, but who is Israel, who's perpetrating the overflowing scourge, and who is the other signatory of the false covenant? Death and Sheol, or Death and Hades, the fourth horseman, they're not even on the world scene at the time the first seal is open. They come down the fourth horseman, and then that's when it says they're killing. They have authority over a quarter of the earth to kill, probably millions of people, and they're not even available to sign on the covenant until they're creating that problem and existing on the world scene. So strike two, the other signatory is not even on the scene until the fourth horseman. And then strike three, that I think is really a troubling, you know, for the traditional view, is the victims, some of the victims of the fourth horseman's killing campaign are called the fifth seal saints. And they're asking a question. They've been martyred, we understand from the details of the fifth seal. They're asking the Lord, how long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? So, you know, the death and Hades are killing them, and they want to know how much longer that's going to go on until their blood is avenged. They've got friends, family, whatever, who are, you know, going through, going to be also killed, and they're concerned about that. And so this, you know, why are they asking that question, okay? This is at a time when the prophetic awareness should be at an all-time high. I mean, there'll be prophecies that have found fulfillment. The rapture will have found fulfillment. There'll probably be 144,000 witnesses on the scene talking about biblical prophecies. And these guys have given their life for their faith, we're told. They're the martyrs. And they're asking, how much longer is that going to go on? Well, that tells me, Mike, that they have not seen the confirmation of the false covenant. They've not experienced that. Or they could know how much longer. They know it's a seven-year tribulation period. So to me, they're dying in the gap. So strike three is, why are they asking that question? It implies that the false covenant has not yet been confirmed, and thus the tribulation period has not yet commenced. So strike one, the Greek word for covenant is not used in the first seal judgment when it's open. Strike two, the other signatory doesn't come on the scene until the fourth horseman. And strike three, even then, on the fifth seal, they don't believe they haven't understood that they're in the tribulation, because the tribulation probably hasn't started yet. And but you know, the sixth seal, it's clear that by the sixth seal, when that's open, that the tribulation has started. That tells us that God's wrath has come. In Revelation 6, verses 12 through 17, it says, I'm paraphrasing, when John looked up, he saw the sixth seal. There were cosmic disturbances. Mankind was trying to hide in the caves, all of mankind, rich, poor, free, and slave. And they were saying to the mountains, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne, from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand? So by this, between the fourth, fifth, and sixth seal, the tribulation has got to start, because that's when the wrath of the Lamb is coming out. But, you know, I could be wrong on that. And you know, it's not, you know, I guess the question is, how critical is the awareness of the timing of the seals? Well, I think it's important because, you know, if someone's left behind, and we all know people who we love in our family or in our sphere of influence who have not made a decision for Jesus Christ, and if Jesus were to come to get his bride now, that person would be left behind. And if they have any awareness of the biblical narrative and the prophecies, the prophetic perspective, the traditional timing view of the seals, that person is going to be immediately looking for a world leader to confirm a covenant with Israel and a seven-year tribulation period to start. They will not necessarily be looking for a gap of events that happen. So if, you know, and meanwhile, paralleling that, Satan's going to have deception going on, and people who are giving their life to Christ are dying, and it's not a popular choice because the deception is a much more appealing choice, whatever that deception will be. So if someone is saying, well, I'm that false covenant hasn't been confirmed yet. It's supposed to have been confirmed. Maybe that biblical narrative isn't correct. Maybe this other lie is right. You know, it might dissuade them from understanding the reality is, well, don't look for that tribulation covenant to be confirmed. Look for this harlot religion. Look for this bloodbath of wars and famines and things. The tribulation will start shortly thereafter. So I'm not dogmatic about it, but I think it's important.
Yes, yeah, it is, and I agree with you, Bill. And that's one of the things that I've encouraged other brothers and sisters in the days that we live in. Listen, I have my own eschatological viewpoint, the way that I understand the end times and the prophetic books, Daniel, Isaiah, Book of Revelation. But I'm not dogmatic to the point where I'm going to break fellowship with you if you happen to disagree with me. And listen, I've got a lot of friends that are post-tribbers. I've got a lot of friends that are pre-wrathers. I've got a lot of friends that do not agree with me on eschatological things, but they don't get dogmatic about it and become angry and divisive. That's the important thing. So I appreciate you saying that we're not dogmatic about these things. I could be wrong. It's possible. Folks, we're talking to author Bill Salas today, and we're discussing his book, The Next Prophecies. And just for review, Bill, we're talking about the seal judgments. You've given the alternative view, and I thought you did it very well. The first seal is the white horseman, folks, and that is the Antichrist. That's not the Lord Jesus Christ. He doesn't appear till later. The second seal is the red horse. The third seal is the black horse. And the fourth seal, the pale horseman. Now, Revelation 6, 7, and 8 says that power was given to him over a fourth of the world. Now, you made it a point, Bill, in your book to say that doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to destroy or murder or annihilate one-fourth of the world's population. That has been a viewpoint in the past, but it doesn't actually say that, does it?
Right. That is the traditional viewpoint when it comes to the traditional timing of the seal judgments that has always been taught pretty much by everybody that I've ever studied. John Wolverd, Billy Crone, they all say it, that is the fourth horseman is killing a quarter of the earth. John Wolverd in his Bible Knowledge commentary says that could be up to 1 billion people that are on the world at that time. Remember, the rapture will happen. How many million, countless millions will go with there? There'll be world wars and the second horseman. There'll be famines that come from those wars. A lot of people will be dying, that have been left behind. So we don't know how many, what the head count's going to be. So the guesswork with those who thought the fourth horseman was killing a quarter of the earth range from 1 billion with John Wolverd. I've even heard Billy Crone say maybe 2 billion. But the text does not say they're killing a quarter of the earth. It says they have authority over the fourth part of the earth to do what? To kill. And then it goes on and tells us the multiple means that they will use to do that. Now, I compare that when I teach on this to the sixth seal, the sixth trumpet judgment in Revelation 9, verses 14 and 15. It says in that judgment, which is unrelated to the seal judgments, this is an entirely different judgment. It happens subsequently to the seal judgments. It says, saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. So the four angels who had been prepared for the hour and day and month and year were released to kill a third of mankind. So that text is real clear. They are going to kill a third of mankind, whatever number that is at that point in time. But that is not what's being said with the fourth horseman. So I just, maybe they're killing a quarter of the earth. I'm just taking a second look at that.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Because Mike, the thing is that, it's one thing to say some entity is killing 1 billion people. It's another thing to say some entity has authority over 1 billion people and using that global reach to, promote their false gospel and their dirty work. And that's a big difference. Hello?
Okay. Still? Nothing's changed? Okay. I haven't changed anything, so Well, this is a message that the enemy of our souls is certainly not happy with and doesn't want to be heard by folks. Bill, we've already mentioned that your viewpoint and mine as well is that the end times harlot world religion is the Roman Catholic Church. There are some today, though, that posit that it's Islam. And what do you say about that?
Yeah, that's a newer theory. The Mystery Babylon being centered in the great city of Islam, of Mecca, with Islam being the harlot world religion. And that is perpetrated primarily by Joel Richardson and Wally Chubot. As a matter of fact, I had a wonderful debate, discussion, 3 hours with Joel Richardson, called the mystery, Identity of Mystery Babylon, Mecca or Rome. So he took the Mecca argument and I took the Rome argument. And that's a newer theory. Matter of fact, I'm pretty sure when the debate, I asked Joel if he could, you know, quote some of the church fathers or anybody in the past that have ever come up with that, and he didn't have a specific that he could offer that Mecca was the thing. There's a couple of reasons I put forward that are problematic with that. One is Mecca does not sit on seven hills, and we're told that when the angel is revealing the mystery to John in Revelation 17:9, that it is a city, and that city sits on seven hills. Also, we're told in Revelation 18:20. That when Babylon is destroyed, the apostles are vindicated and they're rejoicing. And he's speaking about the holy apostles at Jesus' time. And we had it during Jesus' time, there were two or more holy apostles that were killed by the Roman governing authorities. That was Peter and Paul, and I believe Andrew as well, and Jesus' brother James, the apostle, or might have been John's brother, but there was four, I believe. Mecca had no holy apostles killed under the authority of Islam because Islam didn't even exist till the 7th century. The other arguments are that I think are important. Psalm 83 and Ezekiel 38 are two unfulfilled wars that are predominantly Muslim-populated wars. Psalm 83 has 10 populations that share common borders with Israel. We talked about some of those countries earlier in the program. They are all Islamic. They will be destroyed by the Israeli Defense Forces. That will be a punch to the gut of Islam. Ezekiel 38, there's about 9 populations mentioned. Russia is not necessarily Muslim, but all the other ones appear to be. They will be defeated by the Lord supernaturally. That will be an uppercut to the jaw of Islam, so that by the time we get to the tribulation period, Islam will be compromised. Allah will be losing his Akbar, and Islam will be knocked down to the canvas for the 10 count. So, you know, that's my thinking there. You know, there's about 1.8 billion Muslims in the world right now, and about 600 to 800 million of them will be either killed in these wars, prisoners of war, or, you know, sent into refuge. So it will not, and this is the core of Islam in the Middle East, these countries. So I just don't see it.
Yeah. Yeah. We've already discussed the fifth seal, Bill, and the martyrdom of the Christians thereafter. The rapture. And folks, that's chapter 13, by the way. That, Bill, that was a great chapter, certainly by itself worth the price of the book. Get the book, folks. It's the Next Prophecies, Prophecy Depot Ministries. You can get it on Bill's website, and I know it's available through Amazon and all those places, but if you can, get it through Bill's website. So let's jump to the sixth seal. Bill, sixth seal, and that is the wrath of the Lamb. And I'll go ahead and read Revelation chapter 6, verses 12 through 17 to set the context. It says, and I'm reading from the New American Standard, Revelation 6, starting at verse 12. And I looked when he broke the sixth seal, and there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth made of hair, and the whole moon became like blood, and the stars of the sky fell to the earth as a fig tree casts its unripe figs when shaken by a great wind. And the sky was split apart like a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. and the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the commanders, and the rich, and the strong, and every slave and free man hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the presence of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who is able to stand? Amen. Who is able to stand? The wrath of the Lamb is the sixth seal. Describe that, Bill.
Well, those, you know, I mean, that's when God is going to pour out his wrath on a Christ rejecting humanity, and that is poured out over the seven-year tribulation period, divided into two halves, the first half and the second half. And that's just going to be bad, folks. I mean, you know, we, regardless of what the timing of the seal judgments are, whether they happen in, partially in the gap or during the tribulation period, we don't want anybody that we know and love to be left behind to experience the progressive downward spiral of events that ultimately lead to the wrath of God. Now, the good news is many people will come to know the Lord. There are three groups of Christians who get saved. We're told when the fifth seal saints get their answer that the Lord says to them, you must wait a little longer until your fellow servants and their brethren will be martyred as you were. So we know people will be saved. We find out there's a whole bunch of people coming out of the Great Tribulation in Revelation chapter 7 that had died for their faith. The fifth seal saints die for their faith. But that's the point. There's coming a point of time in the man's timeline where it's called the patience of the saints period. Right now we're in the age of grace, the church age. But there's going to come a time where we're told in a couple of verses in the book of Revelation that's going to be called the patience of the saints. And here's what it says in Revelation 13, verse 10. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here's the patience and the faith of the saints. And these are saints that will be martyred at that point. And here's the more definitive verse in Revelation 14, verses 12 through 13. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are those who keep the commandment of God and the faith of Jesus. Then I heard a voice from heaven saying to me, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, that they will rest from their labors and their works will follow them. So basically what we're talking about is it's going to be a blessing to die. Things, you know, blessed are those who die in the Lord now. Things are going to be so bad, it'll be a blessing for them to die and have their eternity in Christ. And the only thing they'll be waiting for at that point is the second coming, but they'll die beforehand in the gap and or in the first or second half of the tribulation. So, you know, what we're trying to say here, folks, is, you know, we got the age of grace right now. This is a time where you can accept Jesus Christ. And especially in America, the persecution is minimal. It's not like that in Iran and other places. But, you know, it's time to make the decision for Jesus Christ, because what is forthcoming, so well described in the book of Revelation that we've been sharing on this program, is nothing that you would want to experience or you'd want any of your loved ones to experience. So we're saying make that decision now, because we don't know how much longer we've got until Jesus comes to get us.
Yes. Amen. Amen. Well, we are almost out of time. I do want to open it up for any questions that folks in the queue might have. If you've joined us here in the huddle and you have a question for Bill, then please ask that question now, and Bill will answer that for you. Are there any questions anybody has? Any questions? One of the things that while folks are getting up the nerve to ask a question, Bill, another feature that I appreciate about your book is that you tackle the subject of the Marian apparitions and how they are really prophetic fulfillments of end time prophecies. I appreciate that, because I happen to agree that these appearances all over the world, and there's a lot of researchers that have chronicled these, but these so-called appearances, to me, it is an effort at deceiving people and keeping them out of the faith, actually, because they're listening to these apparitions and they're doing what these apparitions tell them to do. And the end result is they're going to miss salvation through faith alone in Jesus Christ because they're putting their trust in these apparitions.
Well, that's correct. And they believe that that's really Mary, the mother of Jesus. She's shown up throughout the church age. I don't believe that's really Mary. I believe this is a demonic feminine, part of Satan's plan to deceive people. 1531 shows up in Guadalupe, Mexico. 1858, Lourdes, France. 1917, not too long ago, just roughly 100 years back, in Fatima, Portugal. And she's saying, this apparition through her visionaries, that her best works are yet future. She will be seen by the whole world. I've got quotes in the book on this. Here's one quote here from Queen of All by Jim Tetlow, Roger Oakland, and Brad Myers. It says, numerous healings and miracles have been reported at apparition sites. That's the thing, Mike. There's conversions, miracles, and healings around the globe. In addition, the apparition of the Blessed Virgin Mary has repeatedly announced that her most significant signs and wonders, signs and wonders, are yet future. She admits that she has not yet revealed her full glory to the world. She predicts heavenly signs and wonders that the whole world will soon witness. And what are we told when the 2 Thessalonians 2, when the restraint is removed, Satan will come forward with signs and lying wonders? So this apparition is promising signs and wonders. Will they be lying or will they be truthful wonders? Well, I'm going to suggest to you they're going to be lying signs and wonders.
Yes. Yeah. Folks, Bill is going to be at the Prophecy Watchers Conference. I think that's this weekend, isn't it, Bill?
It is, yes, on the 12th through the 14th of October in Norman, Oklahoma. They can go to prophecywatchers.com, prophecywatchers.com, and they can get tickets, and or the live streaming options are really wonderful there, so I would encourage them to live stream if they can't make it to Norman, Oklahoma.
Yeah, there you go. Go to the Prophecy Watchers website and click on the Prophecy Conference, and then you can live stream it. There you go. Jared's right on it as usual. So again, we've been talking with my friend Bill Salas about his newest book, The Next Prophecies. I would encourage you to get the previous book, The Now Prophecies. And by the way, Bill mentioned the Psalm 83 Wars, fantastic book, folks. And yes, I've got just about all of Bill's books. Here's Apocalypse Road. I would encourage you to get all of these books and get brushed up on your end times understanding, your prophetic understanding, and it'll serve you well as you're reading the scripture. Bill, I appreciate you joining me today for the show. And we got maybe, what do you think, two-thirds through? Because we didn't finish it.
Oh, you're talking to me about the how much we got through the book. I thought you were talking about the technological sound stuff. Yeah, we got through barely a half, but we'll say two-thirds to be generous.
Yeah. Well, we'll have you back on soon, Bill, at your convenience, and maybe finish up the book and talk about the great need for Christians to be pressing hard the gospel of Jesus Christ. Thank you, Bill. I appreciate you.
Thanks, Mike.
God bless you. That's it, folks. Remember, renewing our mind is not an option. Be in the Word, be in prayer, and fellowship with your local body of believers. God bless you. See you next Monday.